So, guys, I think the old gods were not very happy with me. Last show, we obviously did that NBA draft analysis. And what happened on my way to the NBA draft this year was I got stuck in probably some of the worst traffic in New York I've ever been in my entire life, because there was a bus on fire in the Lincoln Tunnel. So do you think that there's any correlation between what we did on this show and what happened to me?
Yes, I think Danny cast a Karras.
I'm going to use my deductive reasoning here, Micah, and assume that the only explanation for this whatsoever is that the old gods were not happy with you this week.
How does a bus catch on fire in a tunnel? That seems like the worst possible scenario. That seems like, that's like fire and brimstone. That's like people suffocating because they can't get out of the tunnel.
I love how a bus was on fire and Micah was like, oh, it was so hard for me.
I had to sit and wait for the whole thing. It was really annoying.
In an air-conditioned bus when it was triple digits outside.
You were in
it wouldn't
the bus
give me 4G
fire?
In the tunnel. I could only get 3G and it was just like, Twitter
like,
was slow.
Were you in the bus? You weren't in the bus. You were
no,
in a bus.
No, it was
he was
bus.
Driving.
I mean, if you remember at the start of season 2, Stannis and Melisandre burned the old gods, and what stopped me from getting to the draft? A burning bus. This is no coincidence.
So what you're saying is it's a modern day burning bush for you, Micah.
It's a burning bus.
Yep, pretty much.
Perfect. Well, hopefully it spoke to you what would become the spine/backbone of this episode. This is our first week of like Game of Thrones off of the old structure completely, and it's moved directly into the literature. So we read chapters 0 through 5 this past week, and happy to see so many of those awesome comments and tweets at us. You guys saying that you love the new idea of the format, and for those, a lot of you sitting and restarting to read it, and a lot of you even said that you guys were going to start rereading it with us. So Micah and Selena aren't alone in this aspect.
And that's really scary, because that was like our trump card. Even though I couldn't remember half of the stuff, it was still, I could still be like, oh, but in the books, blah, blah, blah. But now you guys can do that too. What do I have? I have to start being funny.
Eric was just talking about how it's changing for him in his mind. And I just kept hearing him saying, he was like, guys, I'm starting to remember names now.
Yeah. I know names. I am learning sigils, the houses and stuff. Like, we'll talk about this a little later. But did you know that Winterfell, one of the Seven Kingdoms, is as big as all the other kingdoms combined?
Yeah.
Robert says that to Ed.
Ned.
Just can't believe it. Ned or Eddard.
So much for names.
Neddard.
Yeah. I just lost it.
It was good so far.
But it's really great because I have this perspective too. So even talking about it from my point of view, and I've read these books, but I feel like, As far as I'm concerned, like, I read this with the podcast in mind, and it really made me look at the text much different than any other book I think I've ever read, other than like the first run through a Potter book after it's brand new. But like, do you guys get that idea? Like, when you're rereading, because I'm rereading this too, like, did it feel different? Like, you were more analyzing it and appreciating it more?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, my brain was trained for the owns. So, you know, every time a cool line came up, I was like, oh, I got to write that down.
Right. No, I'm reading it on my iPad, and you're able to go through and put notes and highlights, and then it like aggregates them on a page for you. And it's so funny how many I had actually tagged on my first read through, because we had the Game of Owns website already, but I had tagged like a whole ass load of owns from this first book as when I first read through it. So like, I was able to sort of go back them and compare my perspective from before and after the podcast was made.
I feel like at some point, you know, George R. R. Martin should just release an own edition where he just puts in all the epic quotes. Oh, there'll be an entire section just for Tyrion.
Right. We're working on that with them right now. We'll work on that technology.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Do you get royalties for that?
Maybe. I think collectively, maybe it just helps us throw our own fan conventions for like Game of Thrones. Like, we want to throw a con like GooCon, right?
And
that's not a sealant that you would normally find in a garage either. That's going to be the name of the con. So we'll use those royalty fees to start our first convention, right?
Yeah, why not?
Mm-hmm.
In the new Game of Thrones theme park.
Hey, that's not a bad idea. Although, I don't know, would a Game of Thrones theme park really work?
Dude, I can just think of like names for the rides, and like one of them would be Taking the Black.
You're a god medieval
times.
Taking
the Black.
one of them would be making the eight, you know?
Making the eight.
No, a drink would be called making the eight.
Waking the dragon.
You have one where you get the ride to the top of the wall and just look at stuff, and then all of a sudden the lift breaks and you fall all the way down.
Yeah, chairlift to the wall. That'd
slapping the Joffrey, that would be fun.
Yeah, you know, just some good stuff. And there's nice restaurants. You can, like, taste some Pentos cooking. Like, oh, man, they have so many squids here. They're fresh. They can make so much money. No, but yeah, we've had, and obviously we want to get right into the book, but we had such a great response on Micah's Game of Thrones NBA draft idea from a lot of you guys that listen to the show. And I know that a handful of them really stuck out to us. So we found some before the show and we thought we would share some of these draft picks with you guys.
Let's hope no more buses catch on fire and any tunnels blocking people's 4th of July traffic.
4th of July traffic?
Yeah, it's for tomorrow. Oh. You know, 4th of July, Independence Day.
Yeah, tomorrow, just the 4th of July, Micah.
You know, it just happens to be the 230th... 226th or 224th anniversary of the United States of America declaring independence from Britain. Yes.
I was sitting today after filming on the way to come record here. I was sitting and listening to Bruce Springsteen and I was just like born in the USA in it. Like it's time to celebrate. Right, Selena?
I'm absolutely ready to celebrate.
Well, yeah. I'm sure the Sweden will have something fun to do tomorrow.
I'm sure we'll be celebrating you guys' independence.
That's good.
We've been waiting.
So Tren Guayan wrote in, and she's a regular tweeter to our podcast talking about the NBA draft. And she had this to say, drafts, Loris, good with balls. Rob, good at scoring.
Yes.
Baelish, tactics, Brienne. Right. And Eric's fishnet for opponents' immediate surrender.
Oh, God, yes.
I'm not sure what to make of this. Is my fishnet going to be like the new shadow monster and it's going to come out and like force people to surrender or stick a knife through? Like, what does this mean, Eric's fishnet? Am I on that draft team?
They probably both originated from equally shady places, interiors.
Okay. Yeah, because my fishnet was manufactured in... never mind.
Yeah, no, it was manufactured with love, though. I'm sure it was from love.
So Kristen wrote on the hyperbole.com comment thread, so I finally got to catch up and listen to all 13 episodes of the podcast, so here goes my basketball lineup. Hodor, for size and muscle by the basket. Arya, definitely the point guard. She's nimble and quick and should have no problem darting around the defense. Jon Snow, he just looks athletic. I like that. I would definitely put him as guard. That's a good reason. He just looks athletic. Gendry, nice. Him and Arya have a good rapport and would be a pain to guard. I'd put him at one of the posts. Brienne, I'd put her at the other post. This girl even knows the positions. This is great. You always need a little more muscle, and she would probably distract Jaime if he was on the other team. All he would be able to think is that a woman? Yes, that was very good.
Thank you so much. Well, Kristen, that was very, you have a vast knowledge of the game of basketball. I feel like you and Eric should meet and have a conversation about this.
Because there's a few things I still need to learn about basketball currently.
And Jessica writes in, and this was on the Hypeable website, if I am correct as well. My memory serves me, but it says, Brienne and Jaime, these two are the muscle. They are awesome together and both incredibly strong. In regards to Micah's spoilerific comment about Jaime, this hasn't happened on the show yet. In regards to your spoilerific parenthetical inside of this post, Jessica, I would like to say that I cut out most of that, so we're okay. Rob would be an awesome team leader. Look at how many battles he has planned and executed successfully against much more seasoned lords and knights. He is a natural born leader, and unless the opposing team is filled with booted nurses, I think he can easily lead a team to victory. Arya, she is a freaking water dancer. She would be able to dance all around the opposing team to score points. Bronn would be one of those versatile players who could do whatever was needed. Plus, he's a total badass who has excellent aim.
This is true.
So that's true. Good stuff. No, I agree completely.
What is she going off of excellent aim? The fact that he shot a flaming arrow into a sea of
that was pretty excellent, though.
You know, oil to light the damn thing on fire. Like, where's his aim been tested?
It's just like, I feel like before they went out, they sat Bronn down and were like, listen, Bronn, you pretty much just have one chance with this arrow, because if you miss, they're going to know that we're definitely something's up. So you have one chance. So I think he had to sort of visualize it like Walt on Lost and just like understand that that's the only option that he had.
I have to give props to Tren, though, because she was able to put all of that into 140 characters or less.
Wow.
Wow.
And
are you kidding
really
me?
Get to the point. Not to take anything away from Kristen or Jessica.
Yeah.
I'm just giving props.
No, Tran, you deserve like all of the cred. You can have the cred. Our balance is now zero. We've given it all to Tran.
Where's Larry the Wombat at? I mean,
Larry the
Direwolf. I didn't see anything from him. Oh, Larry the Direwolf.
We've got a handful of those that we're saving until the end of the episode because they're just too funny. Like we have to spread it out. You see, because we're like a well-timed baking session. It's like, do you want the cake? Do you want the cake to be moist and have layers, or do you want to singe the outsides and have the frosting not taste as good? You love your kids, don't you? You want the cake to be as good as it can be.
More about cakes and baking. I think of that timer that was going off right before we started.
Anyway, so we started reading the book this week, and we got through chapters 0 through 5. And, you know, we got to start sort of the same way that we did in the television series, which was, in my opinion, guys, don't you feel like this was just the entire concept of this prologue just embodied the definition of what a prologue is almost like perfectly to the definition, even with like the time and the location of it? It was just, I thought it was just brilliantly done.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because you're starting a story outside of like Westeros, which is where your story is set. This is... in a way, it's outside of the normal. It's outside of the norm, but at the same time, it almost better reflects, you know, Westeros because of that. You know, they're north of the wall, but something sinister is up there, and they're tasked with protecting it. And you know, it had the right amount of mystery, it had the right amount of fantasy, and I think the right amount of detail. One of the things I was most surprised about reading the prologue, but also these other chapters, is that there is a lot of detail, but it's not overwhelming or written in a way that is isolating. I mean, these books I found to be, so far, extremely readable.
I gotta say, I totally agree with you. I think that obviously the books are written really amazingly, but I always thought that the prologue in the series as well maybe wasn't, I mean, I'm getting really critical, like I could do it better, but maybe wasn't the best way to start the show because it almost put me off, both when I was watching the show and when I was reading the book, because I was just like, well, who are these people? You know, what is the point of them? And I know, I obviously know what the point of them was, but it was so far removed. I think if it had started with Bran or at Ned or something like that, maybe it would have gripped me. I sort of had to go through the prologue before I was like, oh, this is awesome, you know? But right. Of course, reading it now, I can appreciate it a lot more.
That's usually the case, though, isn't it? With prologues in general, it's sort of this tangential piece that eventually you come back to and have some resolution with later on in the main story. Now, what's different about this is you kind of get the resolution right away with what happens in the next chapter, but you're sort of left to wonder, who are these others and what's their tie to the rest of the story?
It's great to feel the amount of perspective that this prologue pushes in text versus what it did in the show. I felt like in the show it was incredibly less impactful.
I would agree with that. When they're describing the sword that like reflects the light of the moon, but when it's held sideways, you can't see that there's a sword there because the blade is so thin and like obviously made with magic. That was awesome.
It was just lots of great perspective that, you know, within the confines of that forest and what they were doing was able to set the entire tone of everything that would ever come out of anything that has to do with the Game of Thrones book or any of the ones that followed, which is this, that they live in a medieval time where dead is dead. And we have no business with the dead. Through, you know, the way they talked about never trusting what he hears at a woman's tit or whatever, which basically all that saying is, this is the world we live in right now, where it's still a very like male dominated society ish. And you're going to see like sort of the levels of politics change as the wealthier the person gets and then go to a more base value, the poorer the person is, which in a way kind of reflects a lot of the circumstances that we're living through. So it was just like a perfect parody of modern times with whatever medieval universe he was creating, but he was able to do that within a prologue and not to deal with any of the characters that we'll ever care about. And it was really passively done, which I thought was great.
It was passive. That's the word I wanted to use. I couldn't figure out how to work it in. You know, even in the prologue though, like you just said this out loud, but even in the prologue, there were those made for TV lines, like, don't trust anything you hear at a woman's tip, you know, which are like not family friendly at all, but perfect for HBO. And I'm just glad that the books in that way, I guess, because I've seen the series first, the first two seasons of the TV show first, I was glad that the books were, you know, that that they went the same places. There's still that edgy. Even early on, they're harsh. Like you say, he's creating this harsh medieval reality, you know, with these strong characters that say things you just ordinarily wouldn't expect. You know, it's more gritty. It's more, you know, in a way, it's purer because they're in the wilderness and the wide open. So very cool. And, you know, we're just being introduced to this world. I thought for a prologue, it really succeeded.
What did you guys think when Sir Waymer Royce rolls up and he has a meticulously descriptive paragraph talking about basically what a rap song does in one line, which is all black earth thing? Well, he's not terrible. He's not necessarily doing anything terrible. And he's not terribly impressive, but he's got some badass cloaks on. So that's cool.
What was interesting was describing Martin describing their age differences. And how they view that, you know, in terms of, you know, the younger member of the pack being in a way more experienced, you know, and Will is able to climb trees. And they were talking about why they were kind of exiled to the wall to begin with. And all that stuff was just fascinating. Having seen the TV series, I really think it succeeded as a jumpstart to get me into these books. But, and I love it for that. But I love these books. Like,
you've read like five chapters
reading,
and you're like,
really,
oh my God.
I know. I can tell I'm going to like it. I can really just tell I'm going to like it because I'm getting along with the way the info is, and it's just the way the book is written. I feel the connection.
It's like Potter exciting. I don't want to go that far, but it's pretty exciting. No, it's good to
throwing the gauntlet there.
I'm serious though. It's when the harder I'm reading into it, I feel like I'm forced to maybe feel a similar perspective that I felt when I was like 9 years old, starting, you know, Harry Philosopher's Stone, I guess, was when I got it. So, you know, I'm channeling something like that kind of enthusiasm or perspective because I'm forced to be critical for the podcast. So I just feel like it's totally different. And maybe the people listening are feeling the same thing because they want to catch up and they want to understand what we're saying in the show. So you guys listening that are catching up with us, you know, you inadvertently may also be experiencing this really cool thing, which is the ability to sort of read harder into the story and make it be a little bit more special.
One of the things that's always kind of bothered me about this particular type of reaction to a quote unquote deserter, there's no real way to have evidence of what this person experienced. And I think that goes back to what, you know, we were talking a little bit about before. This is, you know, Westeros. This is what happens. You know, there's the King's Justice. There's all these different types of things where that's just the way that it is, and that's how it happens. And regardless of what you experienced beyond the wall, what you say, what you did, you're a deserter. And your penalty for it is death.
Yep.
And there's just no way around that. I mean, you think about all the sort of legal systems and, you know, what we have in place today from, you know, from a judicial standpoint. Back then, or whenever this takes place, maybe takes place in the future after a meteor hits the earth. I don't know.
Right. That's what's going to be.
That's just what happens. You know, you got caught running away from the Night's Watch because you saw some creepy guys with blue eyes, and now your penalty for it is your life.
Yeah. I mean, there's no talking your way out of this parking ticket, you know, like that's just it.
It's cool though. And Micah, you're exactly right. Like, it's all about perspective, which is what I feel like not only the prologue, but also this first opening chapter is giving us, which is just an incredible amount of foreshadowing to what we're going to see. And I feel like reading it and knowing that it is directly a block of foreshadowing, even reading it for the first time, I feel like we could understand that it's doing that without us knowing the future. And I think that it's pretty powerful inside of it.
But what's interesting though, is that this entire, I mean, except for the prologue, obviously when we sort of take it to the main storyline, we're still technically following one of the guys we just saw in the prologue, except obviously we're not following him because he gets his head chopped off. But it is sort of a nice transition, isn't it? Because we're not just jumping from one place to another. We're actually seeing sort of a direct correlation, I guess.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about, obviously with the book, we have this issue of point of view, right? What point of view is the book being told from? And I thought about it and I'm thinking, I was comparing it obviously to Potter because that's the other series I've read. But I wanted to say it's obviously third person, but it's not necessarily third person omniscient because it's like from the perspective of each of the people it's told from, but it's not first person. But at the same, it's just so interesting because it's just like it's the same third person the whole time, but he's just focusing on somebody else, right? And it's not the other thing I noticed was there's no table of contents in the beginning of my book, and that kind of bothered me. Like the chapters aren't numbered. You know, obviously we had to refer to the Wiki of Ice and Fire to get the full list of how many chapters there were. There's 70 chapters in this book, or 70 different points of view. It's just a very interesting way to write your book, you know, in a way that's just kind of sprawling without any kind of, you know, I don't want to say without structure, but without, you know, I don't know, a table of contents. Is that weird?
It's got guts, though. It takes total guts to come out and say, this is the new setup. This is how I'm making it. It's good. It's good to have that kind of confidence, and it really and lets you trust the story early on because they take themselves that seriously.
Especially because, you know, as we move on in reading the stories, we'll find that some chapters don't even have names. They just have vague descriptions of the people they are talking about. And you're sort of halfway through the chapter, you're like, who is this person?
What, like The Prophet? So, isn't that book three? So,
yeah, something like that. It's interesting.
Just big blocks of confidence, though. It takes, you know, that's great. I love it. I love how he married this prologue and this first chapter because we got direct references of what we're looking for, wildlings. Jared, they were describing some of those characters out in the prologue, and we got to learn so much about how rough and ragtag, and how one had been there for 4 years and one had been there for like 30 years, and it was just crazy. And we've got this brand new lord whose newly forged sword was shattered anyway, even no matter how badass his sword was, it was destroyed and they were taken care of. So we get all this great perspective and we get to know about the wildlings and all these things, and they scare us so much. What the hell is this thing? And then we're back. We're in Winterfell, everything's chill, everything's relaxed, everything's calm.
And you know, Eric, you said before that you don't really know what point of view the story is told from, but I think it's kind of interesting that the very first person, like the first proper point of view that we get from anyone, is Bran. Like, we're introduced to all these huge characters in the series: Ned, Jon, your good friend Theon, Rob, through Bran's eyes. Before anyone else, that's the people we see them through, and I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, like, if Bran is extra special for that, or if it was a good way. Because the other thing he's doing is each of these first five chapters that we've read, it's just so fascinating. They're like they're all introductions of each of the different characters, the people who surround them, and what they're all about. And especially with the Dany chapter, it was very clear, I think, to me what his intentions were to have her be, you know, a sympathetic character, like how we're supposed to feel about Bran, or specifically Ed, you know, because we see Eddard or Ned talking to his son about justice and, you know, how it's carried out. And that is obviously extremely important, you know, because he's the head of the house, and we kind of meet all the other people, including his ward, Theon Greyjoy, my good friend. And we find out what kind of man raised these people. And, you know, with Jon Snow, you know, Bran's chapter was a great look at the dynamics of the group, especially Jon Snow, you know, particularly when they find the direwolves. And Bran is admiring Jon's way with words, the way that he's excluding himself and then later, you know, standing up for himself. So it's very, it was just, again, it's very, very fun to read. It's just so interesting to meet these characters.
I think it's very interesting tying back to what we were talking about before with not necessarily just foreshadowing, but perspective, and that, you know, when you reread through a book, you're able to say, oh, George Martin, you're one crafty bastard, you know, and you can do that with a lot of different authors, I feel like.
Bastard.
You know, you can do it with the Potter series. No, because think about when you go and reread through the Potter series, you find, oh, you know, this place was mentioned three books before it actually became important, or this Horcrux was buried in, you know, one of the early books, but nobody paid any attention to it. You know, I feel like there's going to be a lot of that for us as we go through and
story payoffs.
We reread it again. Well, and I really liked, Selena, what you were saying, the fact that it kind of opens with Bronn and his perspective.
If anything, it's almost more romantic to have sort of a young adult's perspective on things because it's still so hopeful. in their world, he's now old enough. They were saying it's his first day that he gets to be this like older person. And so it's a hopeful, sort of charming perspective rather than when you, something like Ned would be more of a worrying perspective. He's worrying mm-hmm. about Robert coming, you know, he's worried about, John Aaron. Like everyone has different motivations when they're older. And I feel like someone of Bronze Age would just have nothing but a kind perspective amazement. So what better way to open with us other than this is this bright, uplifting, sort of amazing perspective that's just in shock because he's never done this before and you haven't either. So let's begin together.
And just on that, like that, here's him as a quote unquote young adult, especially, I guess, to you and Eric, because obviously in the TV series, you know, we've got John and Rob and Theon, who are all sort of the same age in the like mid-20s or early 20s. We've got Bran, who's probably in the series about 12. Yet here we sort of have them like 5 years younger, all of them, except their Theon is still ages, older. Yeah. So does that change your perception of them, or do you still see them as the TV characters? Or
Not for me. I had already read this book previously, but not as hard as this. But even then, because I'd watched the show before I read the first book the last time, it didn't change my perspective. I just felt like the show was trying to tell that same exact story, except just on paper they have to make the people older, so it's more attractive to watch, and it's easier to hire them. I feel like that's just something they felt like they had to decide and be okay with. That was just going to be the reality, but the story would be the same. So I'm thinking of it, just whatever in the world of Westeros in that place,
that
age is
kind
quicker.
Of corresponds to yeah. In our life, they would be older and make the kind of decisions they do.
It's like an exchange rate between country to country with currency. Just the same thing. It's like, well, there it's different, here it's different. That's just their world. You know, it's like a Wes Anderson film. Like it's carefully constructed and to be obviously unbelievable, but you have to accept that what in this universe, you know, everything's possible, but maybe not everyone knows that, but they still live within unlimited bounds and unlimited restrictions. So a 7-year-old can go see an execution and it's totally normal. You know, it's brand new.
When they were talking about Rickon as well, and they were like, he's 3, but he has to start growing up now.
Yeah. It's just about, you know, it's a world where survival is less passive. Like you have to know how to go out in the forest and start a fire if you're lost. And, you know, I feel like countless people living in the world that we live in now would not be able to do that, would probably die at some point. So this is a world where everyone can do it. The rich people, the poor people, the middle people, you know, like even the animals are crazier.
Mm. Yeah. Bigger.
And then there's Hodor.
And then there's Hodor. So let's talk about the direwolves for a moment. I know Selena's really happy about that, but so they find this mother that has been killed. And they hear the screaming or the, you know, whines of these cubs, direwolf cubs. Yeah, direwolf cubs.
Okay, well, I put about like 5 points in the doc for this because this is my absolute favorite scene of, I think, the entire first season, really, because I'm like, I love the whole foreshadowing of this. This is fantastic. You know, this is what I want to see more of. And, you know, we've got, first of all, we've got the obvious sort of connection that even Ned makes this connection, in case we didn't get it.
He's such a hater, too. He's like, ah, man, that stuff's not weird. Everyone's just crazy. It's like, Ned, there's clearly a horn in this wolf that hasn't been here in 300 years, bud. He's like, let's just go to the house, guys. Come on.
Yeah, he's like, whatever. You know, we'll deal with this later in the story. But yeah, so interestingly, his sigil of House Stark is obviously a direwolf, and this direwolf, particular mother direwolf, had a stag antler in its neck, which, if you know, you want to get really pedantic about it, you know, we later find out that, you know, Ned dies with I guess this is interesting though, because a stag is obviously the Baratheon symbol, but arguably it's Joffrey's fault that he dies, and Joffrey isn't technically a Baratheon, so
I think what's going on about this is that basically working for, you know, in the next two chapters Robert tries to recruit Ned,
right?
So I think it's just a symbol that, you know, foreshadowing that if Nedward, I'm just, no, oh so badly. Because I want to call him Edward, but he's not. He's Edward.
Nedward. Okay.
If Ned goes to work for Baratheon, that's what it is. If he becomes the Hand of the King and works for House Baratheon, it's going to mean his death. That's what the foreshadowing.
It was an omen, and he chose not to listen to it.
Or they just couldn't get lions in the north. Like, they couldn't write that in. Too cold for lions. So the lion's not going to kill him. The antler's going to kill him.
I don't know. If Martin wanted lions, he'd write in lions. You know?
But it's a dire wolf mother, though.
Yeah. One of the two things.
Not a father.
Well.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Do you think
that kills the whole thing?
Do you think
it couldn't be a dad.
Things like those direwolves, which haven't been seen in thousands of years, and Theon's like, you know, these things haven't been seen in thousands of years, and Rob says to him, I'm seeing one now, you know. It's just the idea that all gloves are off.
Theon's stupid.
Well,
again,
even though, hang on, everything that even these characters knew to be true can change and is changing. And that makes the story exciting to read.
He did such a great job introducing Theon's character that the second the head was cleaved off of the body and the spray summer wine of blood went against the snow, Theon kicked the head and like laughed, and Jon Snow was like, ass. Like, it introduced like from the beginning, Martin was like, hey, this guy's gonna be a dipshit, just so you know. He definitely kicked a head. So,
well, in the show, doesn't he kick a head also?
I don't remember.
Theon, when he kills...
He does do that, you're right.
Oh, wow.
He wants to get drafted for our football tournaments. But so another sort of interesting foreshadowy part of this direwolf scene that I wanted to bring up, because I read this quote, and having watched the show and read the books once, I just read this, and I was like, huh. Bran is sort of thinking, when they find Jon Snow's pup, who they sort of have to come back for because it had crawled away from the others or been kicked out. Oh. So Bran, this sentence comes in the book, Bran thought it curious that this pup alone would have opened his eyes while the others were still blind. And, you know, my sleuthing mind immediately just goes, danger, danger, it's it must be some kind of foreshadowing. I'm not quite sure to what, though.
To me, that doesn't make as much sense.
Like, John sees something before the others do, or John, the way that John sees the world has some kind of significance. I don't know, it doesn't necessarily,
That's
just thought it was interesting.
In the John's chapter, Tyrion says to him, bastards grow up the quickest. Or perhaps that's in the John chapter when he's talking to his uncle about it, about joining the wall. In fact, I think that's where it appears. Yeah, he says something like, you know, bastards do grow up the quickest, and his uncle says that's true. But yeah, I'm just thinking, like, John's albino wolf has his eyes open and all the others are still blind.
I guess maybe it doesn't mean anything. I think I'm just looking for this, you know, the significance of these wolves to actually be anything. Because, I mean, I've said before that I sometimes worry that some early foreshadowing or something like that is I don't know, it changes along the way, or maybe George R. R. Martin decides not to go back to it or something like that. And I really think that the fact that these wolves came to represent Stark's five children and Jon's and all of that, it has to mean something in the story. And at this point in the story, they're sort of just like la la la. Some of them have their wolves, some of them don't have their wolves, as what happens later in the story. And I just wonder, is that going to be significant? You know, is it going to be significant that Sansa's wolf is dead? Is it going to be significant that Arya doesn't have hers anymore? Or is it just, was it only significant for this first part of the story?
It has to be, because again, I'm like, this is the first chapter of any book, like of the whole series, like the first real chapter of the series. So anything that happens has to be like extra important. It doesn't, though. It doesn't necessarily. It could be just like the prologue, right? Setting some things up. But the fact that, I don't know, this is just an odd occurrence, right? It's an omen. Even though Ed doesn't want it to be, that these direwolves match the children, including Jon Snow, surprisingly.
Jon said it, man, and he made everybody feel so small because he was like so selfless. He was like, guys, it's okay. Listen, I don't need a wolf. You guys are the real ones. And he like bristled the hair out of his dark eyes, and everyone's like,
he's 14.
You know what,
Zach?
He should definitely have to. Everyone should get the. Everyone should get a direwolf now. And John's like, yeah, I don't need one. And so they're riding away from the site. And John's like, wait, do you hear that? I think that's another wolf. And then he took it. Now he has one. So I like, well played, Jon Snow. I think he knew about the other wolf the whole time.
He took it and put it away from the group just so they could
maybe,
go there.
Yeah.
And it would be an even...
But he's like a true Slytherin, man. Just a true Slytherin.
Selena, the point about Arya, though, you know, we've seen this show. We know that she does, in fact, become separated from her family. So I think that there is a bit of foreshadowing there with her direwolf. Mm. You know, you mentioned that she gets separated later on from Nymeria, and she herself becomes distanced from her family. So,
but they all get separated, though.
But I think there's a strong connection between what happens to their direwolf and what happens to their specific characters. For the ones, you know, who aren't completely separated, like obviously John and Bran and Rickon still and Rob still have their direwolves mm-hmm. very close to them, but it seems like the other two, you know, could have at least been a little bit of foreshadowing as to what was going to happen to them later on in the story.
Well, I always figured, and this might be like really stupid, but I always figured that it was sort of had to do with how far away they were from the north. Like, I don't know if that makes any sense, but obviously because the Starks are supposed to be in the north and winter is coming and dire wolves and they were from beyond the wall or whatever, you know, Arya and Sansa move south, but Jon obviously moves north. And I don't know. It might be stupid. I'm just trying to desperately find some kind of meaning there.
Well, I have something here before they find the wolves. I'll read it really quickly. It's when Ed, as Eric calls him, is talking to Bran. And he says, "One day, Bran, you'll be Rob's bannerman, holding a keep of your own for your brother and your king, and justice will fall to you." You know, that happened, I think, a lot sooner than most people would have anticipated.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. Oh, poor Ned. Poor 35-year-old Ned.
Yeah.
So, Catelyn.
The beginning of her chapter, I thought was awesome, because it's a lot about the religion. And about how Catelyn is of this different religion where they sing. She's basically walking into the Godswood to go find her husband, who has to, you know, cleanse himself because he's just killed somebody. I thought it was amazing. And she's talking about they're sitting by this tree that has this face carved into it. You know, most of the time, in fact, she sits with her back to the tree because she feels like it...
It might eat her.
she feels like it doesn't like what she's telling Ned, or there's some issue there with her and the old gods.
But little does she know the reason the tree is smiling is because it just got done with Hodor.
Yeah, that's true. No, she had to fight like a bunch of Deku Babas on the way in there, and some like little skull kids were running around. It was just perfect. She gets to the great tree and Ned's waiting there for her. And she didn't even have to have a sword or a shield to get mm-hmm. through.
I'll tell you what was totally unexpected for me was that in season two, watching the show, that one line with Master Loom was like, "Oh, the children of the forest." Here in the chapter, there are all these references to these children of the forest in the first book. In the second or third chapter, we're reading about how these old children of the forest actually carved these faces in the trees, that they too worship the old gods, and that they are long lost. Like, this was unbelievable. I was like,
children.
Oh my god, children of the forest. Freaking out, like, you know, I want to know more about this magic history, like we were saying on the show. But in the book, it's been here all along.
You think you'll ever cosplay as a child of the forest?
I don't know. Do they wear fishnet?
I was hoping that they might, but I think that they might wear
might
more
not
of
wear
like
anything.
A green-based, it's like a green-based tunic, some like tree bark.
Free people.
Kind of they like what they're wearing in Jedi.
They all have fairies.
I thought it was great as well to see the perspective from Catelyn talking about all this religious stuff. And I thought it was really sweet when it was talking about how Ned like took care of her praying situation too out there, because he didn't want her just to take his, but to also keep hers. Or I think it was just keep hers and just maybe let's ignore the fact that she doesn't believe the same way he does, which I think that they were casually doing. But she comes out and he's just like cleaning his sword on that sweet, like it's the best artesian water you can find.
Yeah.
And he's cleaning his blade that's like huge and like it's at least 400 years old because they folded the steel 100 times, even though like the strongest blades that people use in like American warfare history, which is like the katana from like Chinese lore, usually is like 9 times folded steel. And this is like 100 times and forged with magic. So
yeah. There
you go. That's a little bit of awesomeness. And she comes up and she's just like, "Hey, how was it?" "Oh yeah, that's cool. I got some bad news. you had a good day, but
in case you weren't feeling shitty enough for jumping guys off, I've got some more.
I need
news
to tell you this before you go back and like Jory or someone like just like makes a comment about it and you feel like I was keeping something from you. Like I want to make sure our relationship's number one priority right now. And this is what
I
happened.
I love them. I ship them
sad.
So hard.
Yeah. What does it mean? I got to ask you guys to foster somebody. They talk about this a few times in the first five chapters. Like, John Aaron was basically like a father figure to Ned because he fostered him. What is that? Like, was Ned an only child? What does that mean?
No, think of it like how Theon is in Winterfell, except not as, like, by law or slavery.
Yeah,
it's like,
they take their children away to raise them with other children in noble houses to sort of foster the connections between the houses.
Yeah, it's like they're building their future. It's like, so Robert and Ned, before they were, you know, because they usurped the crown, so they were probably some sort of nobility. They were nobility, but they weren't like, you're the king nobility. So they were growing up as kids, just like the kids in the Game of Thrones universe are growing up now. Like, just like they were Arya's and Sansa's and Jon's and Rob's, except they were together, and they, Lord Aaron was their Ned Stark, essentially. He was their dad.
Okay.
And I feel like the show does such a bad job, comparatively speaking, to the book, and really painting how important Jon Aaron was to Ned and how he actually was his father. So we get to see, when she tells him this, just like, you get to see Ned get hit with basically his dad just died, essentially. And so it's a big deal versus what I felt like it was in the show. Like, I felt like it was just, you know, not that big of a deal.
Yeah. And now things work in the books a little differently than they do in our world. Wasn't John Aaron going to marry the older sister of Catelyn? Did they or something? They said,
yeah, he married John Aaron married her sister, her older sister.
And so they became brothers. Because they're talking about brotherhood too. And I'm like, okay, were they brothers? Were they fathers? Were they, you know, this, that, the other thing? The point is that they're close. And that this was a tragic loss that I also felt was skipped from the show.
Let's just like imagine the wedding at the Vale or whatever and stuff like that. You know, I'm just saying like they went through so many life experiences together. And so they're, you know, he's older and he's doing his kingly stuff from the throne they usurped that he fought with him during. And, you know, he's doing his regent in the north stuff. So I feel like there's just such a deep life. Like I'm going to compare it to the Marauders having their childhood in Hogwarts. Like, there's so much perspective that we know is there. And that I feel like he told us passively within like two sentences. And within the sorrow in Ned's eye when he looked at Catelyn. Like, we learn all this perspective immediately. And it just makes the characters that much more deep.
I wrote this line down while reading this chapter. But I think Ned says to Catelyn that the others, and this is Children of the Forest again, I'm going to mention, sorry, but he says, the others are as dead as the Children of the Forest gone 8,000 years. Okay, but the prologue of the book shows an other. And so, again, there's this renewed hope that these Children of the Forest, mysterious, lost Children of the Forest, are going to come back.
Oh my God.
You know,
there's always the possibility that maybe they were just from the tail section and they weren't really the others.
Oh my God. But you know what I'm saying though? Like, it's just like J.K. Rowling in certain scenes where characters will say, oh, they're as dead as, you know, or they're, you know, this and this equate to each other. But then as the reader, you're treated to this extra knowledge because you've read the previous chapter or the next chapter and you're making the connection. So.
Yeah, but we're also told in the prologue that dead is dead. And that's just how it is. So it's just so many of these reoccurring thematic elements of death. Exactly. And it's just, it keeps coming in and out throughout the story.
Valamogulis.
I thought, you know, really another thing that was really done very well in that chapter was when Catelyn's also like, hey, PSS.
You mean
Robert's also coming over, and he's like, what? It's like she came up and gave him all of this like crazy news. Like, he's like, damn, like she couldn't text him ahead of time. She just had to go tell him. And she's like, by the way, Robert's coming.
There's no cell reception in the Godswood.
Apparently. Yeah. Also, he's bringing the entire realm and 100 soldiers.
Yeah. But when he's told about Robert, you get that sense of elation on his part. And you also get, I think, and you do see this in the upcoming chapters, just how much of a bond the two of them have with each other. We talked about how John Aaron was like a father figure. You know, Robert is really a brother to him. You know, yes, he has other brothers, obviously. one he's already lost in Benjen, who he recalls from the wall. I'm not really sure how that works. Is that like calling them up from the minor leagues or something? Like, what does Benjen, what allows him to be able to visit from the wall versus, you know, any other member of the Night's Watch? But, you know, there's that really strong...
Or something, isn't he? Or some kind of...
Oh, that he has shouldn't some kind be of anything.
He's just bros with the king. You think that shit doesn't happen nowadays? Come on.
That's true.
Yeah. Like, he's just like, they're like, hey, man, we want to visit.
A temporary leave.
We haven't been here in a while, so let me go and... I've stayed up, like, 30 vacation days. Like, we'll be good.
vacation days.
Like, all right, Benjen, you're straight. You can go. And the king called in a few favors. He knows a few people. And he's just going to march his happy ass out to, you know, winter is coming itself, Winterfell. And they're going to be hanging out in Winterfell. And so Ned is just pumped. He was just like, dang, how long has it been, that bastard? And he was like, she would just leave without giving me any kind of warning. So, like, he's just like trying to get his place looking cool, like make sure that he has like all the posters up that he used to have up when he was a kid. So, like, Ned doesn't think, or Robert doesn't think he got old and he's into like other shit now. Like, he's just excited to hang out with his bud, you know? And, you know, he doesn't even care that the Lannisters are coming. They suck. He does not like the Lannisters, but he's just like, whatever. Like, imagine Robert. Just really think about this. I don't know if many people ever really think about this, but he straight up was like, hey, I want to go see Ned because I think Ned should be my hand. And like 150 other people had to drop their entire life and just walk on a road with him for like 3 months to the north. Like, that's some sway. He's got some power. That's pretty cool.
It's true. And even later on, we find out how much he doesn't like the Lannisters when, you know, there's that discussion between him and Rob about who Jon Arryn's son should go live with. And you get how much disdain he has for Tywin Lannister. Sorry, Eric.
I want to talk about more writing. When Robert and Ned finally meet, Ned's a little surprised because Robert, you know, used to be this really, I want to say, ripped warrior. In fact, the line from the book...
Now he rips his clothes.
Yeah, I have to... he had a giant strength, and his weapon of choice, a spiked iron warhammer that Ned could scarcely lift. In those days, the smell of leather and blood had clung to him like perfume. Next paragraph, now it was perfume that clung to him like perfume. And he had a girth. Wow. He had a girth to match his height. So that's just amazing, right? Descriptors. I'm like flipping out because I love
it. It's sad though. It makes you like miss it. Like, I want to know him in his glory days, like with a warhammer, just walking around like, you know, he's trying to grind his World of Warcraft character. Like, but he's just really serious.
I am Robert. I smash.
But exactly. It's a certain truth to, I think, because every one of us has had our, or will have our glory days, right? And maybe not in war, maybe not in battle, or life or death, situations. No, but I mean, we can aspire to, right? I mean,
I would love to have glory days for sure.
Okay, let me.
There's a song by Bruce Springsteen. Yeah. If you want to, I know you were listening to
it. Let me rephrase. It's a very human thing to look back on the past and be like, oh, you've changed for the worse, right? You've lost it. You used to be this great warrior.
I don't think that's a human thing. I just think that happens to some humans.
Okay.
It doesn't happen to very many people I know, but it does happen to some
glory days?
People.
Nobody has glory days?
You it's kind of a sad older. Existence, though, don't you think? You're just like old and like, I hate everything now. I'm just depressed about everything, but man, stuff was real good back then.
No, the way Robert takes it, like, that's the... well, we know how Robert takes it because he talks to Ned about being king and how much it sucks, but still, I think in general, he's managed a pretty happy existence.
That's what Martin was meant to do, though. He meant to make us sort of look down on Robert for not being the strong person that he always was. He could have ended up like Ned. Like, he could have still been ripped and like looking like a good-looking dude. But instead of he was fat, and he sort of has lost a lot of respect because he stopped working hard and he stopped being himself. He's susceptible to the ease of the luxury. And so that's a way for Martin to sort of... His fall from grace, and the only reason he has glory days is because of his weakness as a character. That's what he was trying to paint.
And there. That's another way in which I think Martin sort of really effectively positions the reader in terms of whose side we're on. Because really, I mean, I know, Eric, you just said let's skip Daenerys to talk about Ned. But in these first 5 chapters of the book, not counting the prologue, 4 out of the 5 are Starks. Like, we get 4 Starks thrown at us straight from the beginning, and then 1 Daenerys thrown in. But imagine if these books had started with the perspective of Robert and Jaime and wow. John Aaron and
completely different story, wouldn't it?
Cersei, yeah, we would have been like, you know, yeah, these people are kind of bad, but the Starks, they're kind of, you know, stuck up they're with their winter is coming.
This is
and
some
what
brilliant
the hell.
Stuff, guys. This I know, is really yeah. brilliant.
That's
yeah.
really cool, isn't it? Because like we would have sort of had that perspective of being like, yeah, we kind of like you, even though you're bad. And now
can
we just
you
have
imagine
the
if Potter was written like this? How crazy that would be.
Draco Malfoy's perspective.
That's what
Voldemort's
I'm saying.
Perspective. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, be called Harry Potter.
I guess that's what I was right. getting into. That's what I was getting to about. That's what I was trying to get to about the perspective. Like, because I'm thinking of the third person in Harry Potter, because it's telling us what Harry's thinking, but with the few very rare exceptions, it never strays from Harry. So is it like the same? Is it like it was just a Harry chapter in the Game of Thrones book? You know what I'm saying? Like, is it that
yeah,
same?
Yeah, no, that's what it is.
A Harry
yeah.
chapter in the Game of Thrones. Oh my God.
Yeah,
Harry, that would be a little weird like, at this point.
He's what just, am I doing here?
Weird. My forehead doesn't hurt. This isn't normal. He's like, I should find a train station. And he just keeps trying to walk through a wall. It's like, Harry, get away from there.
You're not Hedwig.
Selena, well, there are great halls in Winterfell. We know that.
Yes, there are.
But anyway, Selena, I love what you were saying about Martin positioning the reader. I felt when reading the Daenerys chapter, he was completely positioning us to feel such sympathy for her. Because of the mm-hmm. way she acts and the way, like, all the stuff that's said about Viserys.
Viserys acts, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
basically saying how terrible he was, you know?
Yeah, and just seeing the stuff that he does to her, like, he's groping her and causing her physical harm and has that. I was so glad that this was in the book. Obviously, it's in the TV show where, you know, he's talking about selling her to the Khal and being like, I'd let him and all his men and their horses have you if it meant that I got to the, you know, the king, to the throne.
And she's a poor 13-year-old girl, and here we go with the age difference as well, you
and
know?
And this
it's
whole time
terrible.
She's yeah. thinking, like, I don't want to wake the dragon, don't want to, yep. you know, which is, at my house, this is how things work in my house, waking the
oh,
dragon
no,
means
Eric.
Something a little bit different, okay? But for Viserys, right, waking the dragon is just when he gets angry, right, and starts abusing her. She's abused. She's an abused child, and she really has no choice. She's never seen these vigilantes or these, what do I want to say?
The hired knives.
The hitmen,
yeah.
yeah, the hired knives that her brother says still exist. You know, and are chasing them from town to town, so they're never at one place.
Why can't hitmen just use swords? You know, just it's so much more efficient than a knife.
And a knife. yeah, so she's really along for this journey that her brother's leading. She has no control over her fate, and I think she's really susceptible to our sympathy. I think Martin did that on purpose, and it's very clear that he wants us to be. I think it's very clear that he wants us to be sorry for her.
Comparatively speaking, from the books to the television show, I thought it was incredibly fulfilling to see a deep backstory to what exactly Dany and Viserys were doing before they were with Illyrio and before they had started this entire deal with the Khal and all of these things. Like, how the hell did they get from the Kingslayer killing their dad and Rhaegar being killed? Like, how did they get from there to this place 13 years later? Because Dany hadn't even been born yet. And so they tell about this, like, crazy stormy boat ride and all this shit and how Viserys really hates Dany because maybe, you know, Dany, the mother, died during childbirth, right? So
Yeah.
Dany's the one that's responsible for her death. So he was alive during this entire thing, and he remembers all of these things. And so he is just filled with the severe hate of his family being slaughtered and him being kicked out of his home because he was raised as a royal. He was raised to be the next king. So it's someone like Joffrey having the rug pulled out from under them, and he has been forced to sort of be brave and to be rough and to be shifty and to be cunning his entire life just so they would stay alive and not be murdered by these people chasing mm-hmm. them.
Plus
so,
he's crazy, you know.
Yeah.
He's mad.
Plus he's
That's
crazy,
what they
yeah.
say.
And then
there's
they
like
reach
a,
this point.
A 50-50 chance that Targaryens are going to be mad, and clearly yeah. you know, Dany and Viserys kind of split at that one.
It was just great. It was such a big image that they painted, and I just it felt like I disliked Viserys a lot less after I knew that much about him, and then they yeah. go right into him being an insufferable asshole, so it works.
Well, I mean, even in this chapter, words that I'm not familiar with, reading this book, words like usurper, words like kingslayer, which you just don't hear the word usurper. You know what it means. You can look it up. But, you know, Martin uses it so efficiently that you know, and you're like, okay, which one's the usurper and which one's the Kingslayer? Well, the Kingslayer's Jaime, usurper's Robert, right? Or also Ned sometimes. But Martin keeps it straight, so you can begin to rely, you know, on that when Viserys is thinking about or talking about a usurper. Oh, he means this guy, you know, Kingslayer, oh, he means this guy. And you can really, it's like a way of getting the story straight, but using, like, playing Martin's game. Because he's talking about it and he's so immersed in his own world about, you know, portraying this that we're getting the backstory, but he's not necessarily spelling it out for us.
Another interesting thing that got brought up in this chapter was when Daenerys was talking about how she had always thought that she was going to marry her brother. And here she is now being given essentially over to Khal Drogo. We learn that it's pretty common practice for Targaryens to marry within their family. Did this strike anybody as kind of being a little weird, a little odd, or did you, based on what you've already read in these first couple of chapters and sort of the practices and things that you've seen, say, okay, these were the times and that's what happened?
You gotta keep it pure, Micah. Haven't you read Harry Potter?
Oh, God.
No, like, I never got it in Harry Potter either, because you see a family tree where they're all pure, and it's getting narrower, right? You can't just keep sleeping with your brother and your offspring, can you? Because eventually the family tree just dissipates into one, like, two or one person, doesn't it? It doesn't, it goes the opposite way than what it should, shouldn't it? Doesn't it?
Yeah, but then there are new purebloods made every time, you know, you get a second generation. Anyway, this isn't Harry Potter. But no, I think that in terms of it, this story, I was going to say Lord of the Rings now, too many stories. I think what threw me off was that we get this introduction to a family of people we like, at least we like Daenerys. You know, we're introduced to her being really sort of a good character, a point of view character. She's saying that she's basically a product of a long line of incest, and she herself expected to enter into incest. Okay, that's the world. Then in a few chapters, we go to Cersei and Jaime, and it's this huge thing of, oh my God, I cannot believe they're doing this. This is an outrage. You know, if the kingdom finds out, blah, 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 blah. And they're all sort of moral about it, where I'm sort of sitting there going, well, okay, but they're all blonde. I mean, what's the difference, really? You know, why is this so bad when the Targaryens could get away with it? I don't know. That's jarred me a little bit.
That's why it was so important that he made mention of it. And that's why it's really stuck out to me in this chapter, because basically what he's doing passively is saying, hey, the Targaryens really do consider themselves like dragons. And so they see themselves as beasts, essentially, just very powerful beasts. And in order to keep their line clean, they will behave however they like, and they will reproduce within the family just to hold these bloodlines. And it's totally okay. And that paints the context of them being these just mad people, just totally batshit crazy and scary. And that's why Viserys is so scary. And that's why Dany having a kind demeanor is such a big deal, and why we actually should like her, when in all reality, inside of her, she's got this just like very powerful person that could come out because she's from this sort of people.
Yeah. And we know they are magical, you know, but we know they do have some fire in their blood or whatever connection to the dragons.
That was in the Eddard chapter too. I read this one paragraph where it says that basically before the dragon lords came over from the sea, the Starks had proclaimed themselves kings in the north. But then I was thinking, wait a minute, were the Targaryens not originally from the Westeros area? Did they come over from the sea that they're now exiled to? You know, little things like this that are the history that I want to know more about these dragonborn people, where they came from, and what their connection is really with these dragons. It's super awesome. Mm-hmm. So, hey, guys, I have to actually head out real quick. I have full confidence in you guys to continue without me. So,
thank you.
Let's say an official goodbye to Mr. Eric, who has previous engagements this evening. Goodbye, Eric.
Goodbye, everybody.
Farewell, Eric.
I can't wait to read the next five chapters.
Are you going
to
say bye to Eric, Micah? Isn't you too angry?
No, I'm good, man. Enjoy yourself, Eric.
All right. Bye, Micah.
Okay, bye. Well, that's how it normally goes. Eric had to leave. That's sad.
That is sad.
Well, I guess it's okay because we didn't have a Theon chapter this week, so technically we're fine.
We talked a little bit about the Eddard.
Yeah. So should we mention any of the call stuff? Like, because we just met Khal Drogo for the first time. I feel like we should talk about that.
Yeah.
You want to talk about
basically, Selena? I'll talk about it. Basically, Khal Drogo is really hot, but really terrifying. And poor little Dany, you know, is sort of just wants to go back to her red door, basically. And there's this giant of a man with hair past his buttocks or whatever he writes in the story.
No, you're right.
I thought that
almost
was brilliantly
exactly done.
I remember that stuff.
You're like, I memorized this part.
The important
I highlighted
things.
It.
I think that it was so brilliantly done the way that Martin sort of described this imposing figure who we really know nothing about this guy except for what Viserys tells us. But it just paints a picture of what Daenerys is going into. And we, I think, as the readers, are immediately just terrified for her.
I think that we were supposed to like him, though, because aren't, like, people who are light on their feet, like, aren't they just likable, you know?
I think he was, meant to be just... Maybe, I don't know. But I think... I have never thought about that, actually.
You know what I mean?
But, spry, I think it was just meant people to be, like, this really imposing sort of good-looking figure. But the fact that she said, you know, she was... Like, he just looked really mean. And he just looked terrifying.
Right.
Like, the look in his eyes terrified her.
It's kind of describing Micah a little bit, honestly, the first time I met him.
I know.
his hair was he's so light on his feet.
Selena said the same thing, but... Selena has not yet even met me,
that
kind of
imagine,
scares me a little bit.
That's perfect. No, it was cool to finally meet Drogo, and I feel like this is one of those perfect examples where I kind of wish, on one hand, that I would have read the book before watching the show, because when seeing something that I'm a fan of get adapted to screen after the fact, I still retain my original characters in my head, which I feel like isn't that big of a deal, but it's kind of a cool thing. So I can't really read this book without seeing HBO's depiction of Drogo. And it's funny stretching him to an even taller body in my mind. It's like really funny. So I'm imagining lots of eyeliner and it's cool. It's cool. It's nice to reread it.
He's perfect though. Jason Momoa.
I agree.
Most perfect cast people in the whole show.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was nice. And I thought it was cool how just like teen movie Dany was throughout that entire chapter, just like young. And like Martin did such a good job capturing like a young, like teenage girl's mind. Just kind of thinking about superficial stuff, you know, like my brother's weird, you know, and stuff like that. Like the whole time, like it was cool. I liked it. It was very bright.
Yes.
I think it's a good point, Zach. And I think that we talked a lot in the last couple of episodes about Daenerys season 2 and how we've sort of become disconnected with her. But, you know, now going back and reading the books and kind of thinking to season 1, you can understand how people got a bit captivated by her in a way, not just because she was naked in several scenes, but because you sort of feel sympathy for her. You know, she's kind of all by herself, you know, dealing with her brother, dealing with Illyrio, and entering into a situation with Drogo that you're not exactly sure what's going to happen to her. I mean, it's almost like she's being sold into slavery, and there's a huge question mark as to what's going to happen. The other character that comes up in this particular chapter we're introduced to for the first time is Jorah.
Mm.
And he was it was a very sneaky description, but he was just like he was a very attractive over 40s man is what I took out of it. Like he was just athletic and still a badass.
I liked, but before we move on, I liked your point about Daenerys being sold almost as a slave, because I think that's something that I feel they lost in the series majorly, at least so far, with how she feels about slavery, basically.
Exactly, yeah. That plays such a huge role. I mean, it did in the past season on HBO, and it will continue to, you know, moving forward. She has this really strong feeling towards seeing people enslaved and trying to free them.
And she really doesn't like it when she loses her dragons either. So she also feels passionately about that.
Yeah, that pisses her off a little
bit. Well, I guess next up we have Mr. Eddard's chapter himself, and it was a long time coming. I felt like we had to go through other chapters from these other people, and I felt like just the moment Ned Stark was introduced to me through the eyes of Bran, I was just like, well, this is the guy I got to figure out about. And it's not just because of Sean Bean either. Like, he just seems like a very interesting guy, and it was cool to finally see some stuff from his perspective and to see Robert for the first time,
yeah,
obviously.
I just love Ned. I love Ned. I did. Why he die?
shock value. HBO is very strong.
That was HBO's fault. You know, they went back in time and sold George R. R. Martin.
Like, listen, guys, I think that you might want to think about killing off your main character.
I think you want to do a Lost here and kill off Jack, but different.
In the pilot, just leave him out.
Yeah.
Perfect.
That's
what
they wanted to do.
No, that's great.
So Ned was chilling in the crypt with his homie and...
Rob.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you really get more backstory here. And you do get some of it in the television series as well, but you also get a really strong sense for how much Robert cared about Lyanna.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, clearly he had very strong feelings for her and got very frustrated with what ended up happening. And he even at one point says that she doesn't deserve to be buried down here in this dark, dirty crypt beneath the earth. She deserves better than that. And, you know, Ned tells her, well, I was with her when she died and this is what she requested. And you really get that first introduction to the crypt as well, where all these, you know, former, what would you say of Winterfell?
Is it Starks?
Starks, yeah. But I meant like Lord. I was going to say King.
Like hosts
really king.
Of Winterfell, like the people that, the stewards of Winterfell, essentially. Like a kingdom will live longer than any person. It's like what Tyrion, or it's what Tywin's character Charles Dance was saying in the second season of the show, where it's a greater good. It's the more of the reputation of your family, not more than the individuals within it and your place that you guys are the stewards of is Winterfell. So it gives you the grander image, you know, which is a big thing and that they did establish really early on. And I thought it was great that what Martin did in this chapter and just really, really, really made us like Robert. I felt like it was like we understood that he was slightly less intelligent than he was before. He let the laziness get to him, but he still was very passionate about Lyanna having a good grave and things like that that were really honorable, it seemed.
Mm-hmm. We also got our first description of that scene that I'm sad that Eric left because I wanted to prove to him that I wasn't spoiling him when I was talking about the Promise Me Ned reference that Ned sort of plants in our minds, or Martin plants in our minds, I should say, from very early on in the story, that she was lying in a bed of blood and roses. And she said those words, and we still wonder what exactly she meant.
Yeah. It's
and the Krennic man was there.
And the plot thickens.
And you also get, like I said, a bit of that backstory. They talk about, you know, how they sort of join forces to handle Balon Greyjoy. And the other name that gets mentioned really briefly in here, who I know is the father of some of Selena's favorite characters, is Howlin Reed.
Yes. Yay.
Like she's like I'm a dad fan. I'm like, yeah, he made basically a lot of cool people. So
I just like the dads. Yeah.
That's perfect.
Yes, he's the father of Mira and Jojen, who are going to be introduced in season 3. So yay.
Nice.
But yeah, this is just one of those situations, especially when you get in all this backstory where you're being introduced to characters who maybe don't have relevance until later on in the story. Maybe they never have relevance ever again. You're just kind of hearing those names, but you know, you're like, oh yeah, you know, I know who that is. That makes sense now. And I just think that you get towards the end of this chapter and all of a sudden now you have Robert asking Ned to be Hand of the King.
Boom, boom, boom.
Beginning of the end.
It's the new Defense Against the Dark Arts position, everybody. Uh-huh. It's the Hand of the King. Come on down. Welcome to the club. And everyone dies. Perfect end to everything.
Well done, John, Rob, for like dooming them all, basically.
It's great that he was able to give us all these little victories in the rest of the series, just from this little bit of setup he did, you know, with these two finally speaking face to face. They haven't done it in so long, and they finally got to like have their good like friend moment, which is cool. And they'll have more in the future, which is mm-hmm. great. But you know, we move on to John's chapter, and it's they're finally doing like the big celebration. Like everyone's there. Winterfell's the spot to be. Paparazzi, like, we're like getting at them when they were coming inside. You know, the reporters are going nuts, and it's time to lock the place down and enjoy a fine meal.
And I really do feel like in this chapter, you know, just to continue our trend of all the Potter references, Jon Snow really is the Harry Potter of this story. You know, he's the poor little orphan boy sitting, you know, at another table while his Dursley family, not to call the Starks the Dursleys, but You know, there's a bit of Petunia over Catelyn because she is a bit of a bitch to him.
She is just like Petunia Dursley. Yeah.
But she's nice, though, at the same time. Like, I do like her, but towards John, she's just a horrible human being. And poor guy, and he, you know, gets drunk on fire whiskey and hangs out with Hedwig. And, yeah, it's all good.
I love these references that are happening right now. In the book, with Catelyn, that you don't necessarily see in the show, I don't think you really ever see it. And you get much more disdain towards Jon Snow, and it's seen in this chapter a little bit. She clearly does not like him at all.
I didn't like how awkward she was making him feel. And so we're seeing it from his perspective. And, you know, we joked about the Petunia thing early on. But, like, seriously, though, it was a lot like that. She was just being an insufferable asshole because of something that he had no control over. And
it is terrible.
It's, you know, it's actually a theme that's told in a lot of different stories. And it's so neat to feel it inside of this medieval world, because I feel like it's another, like, BSG kind of thing where, like, it's like, Will Adama's like, you know, there's some problems or whatever. Well, this is just drama within your, like, your royalty. You're like the leaders of this society and you guys have drama too. But, like, it's not less of a big deal just because they're a big deal. It still hurts the same, you know?
Yeah. And I think we get it more in the story as well, because in the series, I think we sort of just have Catelyn introduce this really nice lady, this wife, this mother. And then she has like one scene with Bran and Jon where she's like, get out. And she like acts all crazy. And then she goes back to being nice. But in the book, we have so many chapters from Catelyn's point of view where we get to experience her feelings for Jon a lot more. And we realize how horrible she actually is to him.
But not to her other kids.
But not to the others. No, she's nice.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jon says, okay, well, that's how I'm going to be treated. I'm just going to get drunk.
He starts drinking that whiskey, man. He just starts knocking them back. And people are like, hey, John, don't you want to slow down, bud? And he's like, guys, listen, I've done this before. Okay. I live here. He's like, I don't have to drive anywhere. He just had like those crazy talks. I love when he talked to Uncle Ben. And you say, you have, who wrote Not Kenobi in the doc? Because that's hilarious.
I don't know.
but it's so true, Eric, though. He was acting the same way as, you know, someone like in Star Wars would be, like training someone younger, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Yeah.
Now, do you think he got drunk on Lannister Gold, Frostbite Bitter, Stag Ale, Old Worm, or Ron Brew Stout?
Let's think. He was probably sipping on some Lannister Gold. I guarantee Robert brought a few casks of that because his wife like made him.
Summer wine.
Yeah.
Just to be dull.
Just to bring it down in. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's probably what it was.
Yeah, that's what it was.
All right.
I didn't read this, guys.
I read it, though. I know it was summer.
All right, Selena, make it sound badass, please.
I'll try.
It was a joke because I was reading the own.
Oh, okay.
You know, the one you put up with all the different beer bottles?
Yeah, dude. I remember. I was trying to joke around with it, but she wasn't having any of it.
She tried to be serious.
Yeah, she did.
It's 3 a.m., guys. What kind of wine?
Let's just go to the combo with Tyrion.
Oh, my God. That was the best thing in the world. Are you guys kidding? That was made of so much. Oh, okay, I'll just go into it here. Okay, so John, basically, he is at the feast, and he's hanging out, and he gets wasted. And, you know, Uncle Ben makes an interesting comment. He goes, I'm something son. And John is like, you're not my father, blah, 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 and makes a scene and storms out. And it's all hissy. And then he meets Tyrion. And you have to understand, like, first of all, we get the introduction of all these Lannisters. John is basically watching them all going, yeah, this person's insipid, this person's an idiot, this, yeah, like, the queen looks mean, blah, blah, blah. And then Tyrion comes out, and he is sitting, like, how is this for an introduction for a character? He's sitting on a wall, and he's like, yo, bastard, what's up? And he, like, does this backflip off the wall.
Double backflip, triple axel.
Yeah. And then he goes on to just basically prove why he is the most awesome person in the whole world, and just starts talking about, you know, you're a bastard and I'm a dwarf and my father hates me, but I don't care. And it's just amazing.
He just like lays out this like gymnastics move from London 2012. He's like, hey, what's up?
Pretty much. And I think that, you know, I think that this, they left that out of the show. I can't imagine why. But that they've replaced that with all the sex. I guess they thought that made him look cooler for some reason. But
absolutely. No, that's legit, like, the best character entrance of all time.
It was
like, that's
so
pretty
good.
Baller.
Like, it was so amazing. And then, you know, they have this discussion basically about how John immediately Tyrion comes in and is the voice of reason and just goes, you know, you would need to wear your bastard-like armor so it can't hurt you. And then as he leaves this epic scene of awesomeness, you have this line that goes, that's in the doc, that says, "For just a moment, Tyrion Lannister stood tall as a king as his shadow was sort of reflected against the entrance." And it was like, ah! And I hope that's foreshadowing because I want him to be king.
I think it's so, you know, the line that you talked about is just really applicable, especially in today's society where, you know, he says, "Let me give you some counsel, bastard. Never forget what you are, for surely the world will not. Make it your strength, then it can never be used, never be your weakness. Armor yourself in it, and it will never be used to hurt you."
Mm-hmm.
So,
absolutely fantastic.
That's deep stuff.
It's such an awesome quote.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it's true.
And I guess if we're going into owns from this, my own definitely came from this scene. And it was just, I was thinking, because there's so much epic stuff happening with these introductions, character introduction, but this was just my favorite ever, where, you know, they sort of continue the theme of subtly dropping hints about Jon's parentage, and they're talking about him being a bastard, and Jon goes, "I don't even know who my mother was," and Tyrion replies, "Some woman, no doubt, most of them are." And that's just hilarious. It's like, way that's to bring perfect. It down. Yes.
All right. My turn, I guess.
Wait, Micah, do you have like an incredibly crafted one for us? Don't lie to me. Do you?
Oh, no. It's actually from the same chapter.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, let's hear it, buddy.
It's Tyrion, okay. And he says, "Remember this, boy. All dwarfs may be bastards, yet not all bastards need be dwarfs."
Mm. Dude, good one. That's perfect.
He's always schooling people. He's always teaching.
Yeah.
Tyrion Lannister, again, owning, because mine, I gave my own to Tyrion's intro.
Well done. Yes.
How do you not give an
Is
own?
Is he going to be in the Summer Olympics?
Dude? It's a craftily executed double backflip triple axle. I mean, that sounds like a delicious meal or a delicious trick. So, yes. I think that he gets my own of the week.
I think he deserves all of the owns. Now you guys have to write us in and tell us why other characters might have deserved owns as well.
Wait, I got one. Let me see if I can find one for Eric here, since he wasn't able to be on the show.
Wait, is that what he wrote on Skype?
No, I'm just looking for one. Hold on one second. I should be able to locate one here.
I'm sure it was when Theon kicked the head. Keeping on the Summer Olympics theme here.
Yeah, it's like, hey, can you pick up that head? Because we're trying to do shot put today. So just let me know how long you can toss it.
Yeah, I'm trying to look for something intelligent that Theon says, but it doesn't happen.
Just do Theon kicking the head, Selena. You can just actually announce it.
Okay. Well, I'm deciding for Eric here. I think I can pretty much guess what his own is going to be, and it's going to be that infamous entrance by Theon Greyjoy kicking the head and announcing that he is a bastard. Not a literal bastard, just a bastard in general.
Theon Greyjoy is a head person, head kicker. Mm-hmm. Theon Greyjoy likes to kick heads, so.
He does.
There you go. That's Eric's Zone of the Week this week. I think
that's
we got
what
it.
Eric would have chosen.
I couldn't find anything. They all reek.
And this is the perfect situation to say, hey guys, guess what? Next week we'll be reading your Owns of the Week from chapters 6-10, which I think is a handful of nice little 5 chapters, right, guys?
I think that's the math, yes.
We put the math together, and we thought that's the way to do it. We're going to do 6-10 next week, so that's the new try.
And before we wrap things up this week, just wanted to get back and do a couple more of the Westerosian Basketball League top 5 draft picks. And the first one here from the forums comes from Larry the Direwolf, also known as Larry the Wombat. And he says, "Gotta draft Jaqen H'ghar. Can't put a hand in his face because he doesn't have one."
Mm-mm-mm. Oh.
Next up, Sir Loras. Great at ball handling. All right. Yeah. Trey already beat you there.
Yeah.
Then the Hound. Won't let the other team catch fire. If they do, he's worthless.
True.
It's very true.
Very true.
Fourth, Bronn. Great with elbows.
Mm, try not to get those fouls, though, buddy.
And final pick, Jaime. If LeBron's king, who better to slay him?
Oh, God.
All right. I like that.
Yeah.
That's good.
That's very good.
Very good.
I've got a couple from the left _ lane, and I wanted to do this one because I think she has some excellent choices that are really original. She says, "I've put a lot of thought into this, and considering characters from all 5 books, I've picked my top 5. Arya is first of all, because she's quick as a snake, Khal Drogo because he's never been defeated. We all missed this one, guys. I feel embarrassed on our behalf because clearly, his hair, bast his butt cheeks. We've talked about this.
How's he gonna like? He's gonna put that like in a bun before he plays, right?
He'll have a fishnet thing.
Hold that.
Yeah,
yeah. Metal World Peace get a hold of that.
Like a Minerva McGonagall bun on top.
Oh my god. So yeah, okay. And then
you're reading a list. Sorry.
Then there's Melisandre because she's got the power. Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. Great John because he could spill the bowl on his three remaining fingers. The Great John. I think the Great John is the guy who is with Rob, right, Micah? He's basically Rob's right-hand man. Yep. It's not John or the John we know. And then the last one is Wunweg Wundarwin because he's tall. And I have no idea who this is. By the way, if you're not finished with all five books, don't Google that last name. Seriously, don't. Okay, we will not.
We will not. I probably shouldn't Google it, no.
No, you so will, though.
I probably will.
Selena, you've done all the books.
Yeah, I've done all the books, but I don't want to give anything away.
Okay, on my behalf, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I try.
Insanity writes, here's my Westerosian five. Center Hodor. Seriously, who wouldn't want an 8-foot, 13-inch, 367-pound man down in the post? He takes direction well and would never become an ego problem. Only drawback, he's not allowed to give any post-game interviews. So that would make a little bit of sense. Power forward, Khal Drogo. I'm highlighting the word power. For me, power forward position. Nice for me. He's got a good size and strength that could really intimidate the position on defense. So, yep, Khal Drogo would probably be good at that. Jon Snow is a center, a small forward for the small forward spot. Need to give a good perimeter score and perimeter defender. Snow is born for this spot. There isn't a more elite perimeter defender than a man of the Night's Watch guarding the perimeter of the realm. He's also a proven perimeter scorer. Just ask your grit.
Okay.
Shooting guard, Theon Greyjoy. I need a good sharpshooter for my shooting guard spot. I think the TV series made him look better than he really is, but anyone that can snipe a bird from the sky in one shot is good enough for me. I keep waiting for him to pull a Robin Hood and split an arrow in two, but alas, Kevin Costner, he is not. So, Theon Greyjoy. There you go. And finally, for the point guard position, we have Renly Baratheon. Save the best for last. Renly has the three most important attributes needed to play point guard. First, leadership. Come on, he declared for king without having any kind of legitimate claim, yet he was able to draw more support than his brother. Second, motivation. I doubt he would be too shy to get in that huddle, slap some butts, and motivate. Third, and the most important ability of all, Renly is a premier ball handler. Just ask the Knight of Flowers. Enough said.
Guys. So,
thank you, Insanity. True to form, I think, with your name, sir.
Those were good.
Yeah.
A lot of creative listeners out
definitely.
There.
A lot of creative shit out there. There's a handful more in the forums, and I'm sure there's going to be even more for the next week block of reading that we have, and possibly what we talked over this week, if you guys want to spill that in with it some. But just as a reminder, next week we're going to be going on and on about chapters 6 through 10, and also that following week, a lot of us will be traveling on the show, or a few of us. But luckily, we figured it out to where the shows are all going to be recorded perfectly in time, and we may have some bonus content, because a few of the hosts are going to be together with each other.
That's not me.
And if you want to give us those owns that Zach just talked about, you can, of course, tweet at us at Game of Owns, or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/Game of Owns, or email us contact@GameOfOwns.com. Or, like Larry the Direwolf just did, you could hop on to our forums, which is, what's the address again, Zach?
Let me look real quick. Shit. It's gameofowns.com/forum. Perfectly placed.
Oh, who would have thought?
Who would have thunk it? Or in the different tense of the words.
And as always, we appreciate you guys rating and reviewing us on iTunes. We continue to receive so much great feedback from you, the listeners. And of course, we take what you say. And, you know, if you want to give some opinion, maybe on ways we can improve the show, change some things up. You know, especially as we get into this book discussion, we're open to do all different types of ideas as to how we can structure it and make it more entertaining for you.
And you can find me over on hyperbole.com, which in my own modest opinion, a fantastic resource for all types of fandoms, including Harry Potter and Game of Thrones and Once Upon a Time. And, you know, we've got Comic-Con coming up and we're going to be doing lots of coverage about that. So please go check that out.
Hyperbole is hands down the brightest and most interesting news outlet I've seen on the internet. That's like, you know what I mean? Just like everything that you guys are interested in doing, it's like nothing is half-assed. You guys you guys kill every single like fandom and different kind of topic that you guys cover. So like, well, well done. Like it's doing very well.
Thank you. Well, that's I obviously
HYPABLE.com.
Yes. Yeah, and obviously over at GameOfOwns.com, we have a nice little stream of stuff to you serving the best of Westeros, which basically just means we have awesome bite-sized bits of content from throughout the whole Game of Thrones universe and the books and the show, the crazy shit that you guys make, everything. And it's just been, you know, it's been coasting probably about a month now on the new design on the website and sort of the new mission, and you guys are just destroying. Specifically this week, something that I thought was absolutely hilarious that got a lot of attention from you guys online was the Harry Potter Game of Thrones crossover, which I thought, again, someone probably made because they listened to the show and we just keep merging these two things together. But what was it exactly? Like John Aaron's letter got sent to someone else or some
to
shit
Hogwarts,
like that. What was it?
Yeah, and they're like, what? You know, what is the seed? What is it? The seed is...
Is that a raven? There was a raven in Hogwarts.
The seed is strong. What does that mean? And, you know, this other guy in Westeros goes like, what the fuck is Hogwarts?
Yeah, exactly. Is that supposed to be Ned?
Yeah.
Getting the letter saying, what in the seven hells is Hogwarts?
And so, you know, just little bits of funny stuff, and you know, people dig it. It's good stuff, and I'm glad that you all are enjoying that as well.
All right.
Well, I guess that'll do it, right, guys?
I think so.
Well, we have music playing, and I'm sure that you can hear it with your earballs. That's where it's been for a very long time, and by that I mean 13, now 14 episodes. I'm Zach Louie.
I'm Selena Wilkin.
And I'm Micah Tadabout.
Game of Owns is owned.
It is owned.
We're gonna be 15 next episode.
Yay! Older than Jon Snow.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye, guys.
Bye.